think sometimes we just need to let the story speak for itself. Hopefully this will frame what is to come. When I looked at my notes this morning and just was reviewing and improving my sermon, I looked down and the first word that was written was simply duck. So I was jolly confused by what that possibly could mean. But then it occurred to me, it was about a story that I remember. Now, it's on the theme of not everything is always as it seems. And the duck in question, I was on a river in Canada, and I spotted this duck that was going absolutely crazy. It looked like it was having a fit, and I thought it was drowning, or it was very sick, or it was being attacked by something. And then out of the corner of my eye, I spotted on the other side of the river this little clutch of chicks trying to find safety. And of course, I realized what the duck was doing. The duck was trying to draw me away from her chicks. She was absolutely fine. I'm sure you can think of stories. Things are not always as they seem. In fact, those of you who have got an email purportedly from me will know how many scams there are around, impersonating church leaders and so on. Things are not always as they seem. And nowhere is that more true than on Good Friday. What seems like the moment of greatest hopelessness turns out to be the greatest victory the universe has ever seen. As we watch Jesus go through the darkest moments of his life, we see hints that not all is as it seems. And I want to zero in on his response to the high priest there in verse 62, where the high priest asks him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." And I think in that simple sentence, Jesus reveals a completely different reality. And I think he does that in at least three ways. Firstly, I think we see that despite him looking like the victim, he actually remains in charge. There's something darkly comedic about the trial in our reading. In the hours before his crucifixion, Jesus stands trial for, well, frankly, anything that will allow the authorities to execute him. Blasphemy, maybe. Rumors are that this guy claims to be the Messiah. But the prosecution is all over the place and gets all tied up in knots. And amid endless inconsistencies and no real evidence, it looks like the trial, which is already a farce, is going to fall flat. And of course, the great irony is that this is the one point on which they were correct. Then someone actually thinks of asking Jesus whether or not he does claim to be the Messiah. I guess it hadn't occurred to them to do that, given that all he had to do was say no. And it would be hard to argue against without the consistency of the witnesses. They would assume that he was going to plead not guilty. But if there was ever a moment where Jesus underlines his emphatic determination to go to the cross, it's here. How does he respond? "I am. And you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The way in which it's phrased, at least in the Greek, that Jesus saying, "I am," intentionally evokes the name of God in the Old Testament, Yahweh, "I am." He leaves them in no doubt about his claims, not just to be the Messiah King, but to be God incarnate. And that is the worst and most arrogant of blasphemies. Unless, of course, it's true. You can almost imagine the defense barrister, had there been one, hanging his head in his hands. If only he had kept quiet, they'd have had the prosecution over a barrel. But no, Jesus won't let the people, either in their evil plans or even in their incompetence with which they carry them out, to prevent him from fulfilling the plan he has been committed to all along. I know at the Baptist Church you've been looking at Mark for a while, and so you may have touched on the idea that in fact the whole Gospel of Mark is shaped in a way that reflects this. The first half is up in Galilee, and then you have this pivot point in the middle at the end of the first half where we hear Peter's confession that from all they've seen, Jesus must be the Christ, the Messiah, this anointed king. And the minute he says that, Jesus draws their attention to the cross. He says in verse 31 of chapter 8, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. And then the entire second half of the book is built around Jesus' long, determined march south to Jerusalem, to the cross, knowing exactly what will happen to him there. At no point does he veer from that determination. Some question how the Father could have allowed the Son to go to the cross, as if Jesus was some sort of victim. But no, Jesus remains the constant initiator of all the events that will ultimately take him to his death. Despite looking like the victim, Jesus remains in charge. Secondly, despite looking like the criminal, Jesus is in fact the judge. Jesus' words evoke a dark and dramatic dream from Daniel 7, about talk of clouds and the Son of Man. Many years previously, deep in Babylon, Daniel was plagued by nightmares. The depths of the oceans churn angrily, and grotesque beasts crawl out one by one, each more terrifying than the last, to devour humanity. And these beasts represent the great empires of the ancient Near East, the epitome of human violence and evil, of which Rome was the fourth, the most terrifying of the four beasts. But then in the nightmare, the Ancient of Days steps in, the great God beyond them all. He steps in and brings final judgment on them in the Son of Man. When Jesus claims to be the Son of Man, he is making the grandest claim imaginable. He's claiming to be the climax of God's judgment on evil and death. He's claiming to stand judgment over Rome as the last of those great empires, and implicitly over every regime of this fallen world. But more than that, as we see the story of Mark unfold, we see that fallenness in each individual. Miriam and I have been watching a show called Black Snow, which is on the BBC at the moment, and it tells the story of a cold case murder that gets reopened. And as it goes through the story, what you realise that everyone wants the murderer to be found and punished. But everyone has a secret about how they have somehow contributed to the events that led to this murder. Mark does something a little bit similar here as he tells the story. We all want the oppressive forces of this world to be judged. But then we see the same weaknesses, the same greed, envy, selfishness to be at work in the people all around Jesus as they contribute to Jesus' execution. And I think that Mark does that humbly. I think he points the finger at himself as well. Most commentators believe that that otherwise completely random mention of a man who runs away naked because they've grabbed hold of his robe. Most commentators believe that that is Mark who did that. He's putting himself amidst those who failed to stand up for Jesus, who succumbed in the moment of pressure. He turns the mirror on himself, and I think by doing that he invites us to turn the mirror on ourselves. If we're honest, all the traits that we see in the story here, whether that be in Peter or Caiaphas or Pilate or the rest of the disciples, even the soldiers, those are traits that all of us tend to have. Let me read you the words of a hymn that grabs hold of this so well. "'Twas I that shed the sacred blood. I nailed him to the tree. I crucified the Christ of God. I joined the mockery. Of all that shouting multitude, I feel that I am one. And in the din of voices rude, I recognize my own. Around the cross, the throng I see, mocking the sufferer's groans. Yet still, my voice, it seems to be, as if I mocked alone. Despite looking like the criminal, Jesus is in fact the judge of oppressive regimes, of those judging him, and indeed of you and me. So despite looking like the victim, he remains in charge. Despite looking like the criminal, he is in fact judge. And thirdly, despite looking powerless, Jesus is in fact performing the greatest rescue the world has ever seen. When God destroys the empires of the world in their place, according to Daniel 7, God is going to appoint his own king, the Son of Man, who will come on the clouds, who rides the storm clouds to his throne, who will rule in peace, and who can never be opposed. The claims of Jesus to be the Son of Man grow in their magnitude, even in their absurdity, if they are untrue. He is the climax of God's rescue of his people. He is the one who destroys the power of the accuser. He is the one who pays in his flesh and blood the penalty for our sin. He is the one who rescues us from the evil intentions of the world around us, and even of our own hearts. So, in the events of the Easter weekend and beyond, this claim that Jesus makes, drawing on Daniel 7, will be fulfilled in a number of ways. He will destroy the deathly power of sin at the cross. He will be shown to be that king in his resurrection. He will be enthroned in his ascension. He will empower his church to exercise his rule at Pentecost. So, over the next half hour or so, as we hear the rest of the story, and as you walk through the events of this weekend, remember, it is not always as it seems. Jesus is in fact in charge. Jesus is in fact the judge. And Jesus is in fact the loving rescuer. Let me pray for us.